Earthlit. Are you reading 2000 AD? No? Oh, you really should be.
Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic, this is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thong, Earthlit, and welcome to the 2000 AD Thrillcast for another thrill-powered episode. I am Molchar, publicity droid for 2000 AD, and also the host of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. And we've got something a little bit different for you this week, as we talked to Guy Adams and Jimmy Broxton, who are the pair behind Gold Tiger, the new original graphic novel. Well, graphic novel, artifact, collection, it's difficult to explain. Listen to the interview that we have with Guy and Jimmy about how they have brought this unseen and unknown 1960s comic strip back to life. The reason for my little whispery intro is that 2000 AD this week is one of those jumping on issues where all the stories start together. So you get episode number one of five separate strips. And what a corker of a jumping on point. If you are a non-reader, if you are a lapsed reader, somebody used to read 2000 AD, this is the point to get back on with 2000 AD on a weekly basis. It's specifically designed to make it easy for you to start reading. So like I said, you get all new number ones. We've got Judge Dredd, Grindstone Cowboys by Michael Carroll, Colin O'Neill, Len O'Grady and Annie Parkhouse. We have got a new Tharg's thriller, Repossession Orders Part 1 with Eddie Robson, Jake Lynch and Simon Boland. There's also the return of Survival Geeks, those of you who like a little bit of Neil Gouge artwork. That is quite an opening double page spread that we've got in this week's prog. That's by written by Gordon Rennie and Emma Beebe with Gary Caldwell and Ellie DeVille. Something that that I particularly enjoyed was the Deadwell stories about the Dark Judges that we published last year. Keck W and Dave Kendall have starting a new series based on Deadwell before the rise of the Dark Judges. So if you're a big fan of Judge Death and his fearsome foursome, then Tainted, The Fall of Deadworld starts in this week's 2000 AD and is gorgeous. And also a return of another favourite of mine. If you love Romans, if you love history, if you love violence, then Aquila, Charon's Mercy by Gordon Rennie, Paul Davidson, Len O'Grady and Ellie DeVille begins in this week's issue. And yeah, like I said, this is a corker. If you know somebody who likes the comic books, doesn't read 2000 AD, it is the one to recommend to them. Great starting point for new and lapsed readers. So make sure you go to your nearest stockist and grab a copy of 2000 AD Prog 1973, or it's available digitally through our web shop and apps, which now include a Windows 10 app. So if you have a device, whether it's a PC, a tablet, or a mobile that runs Windows 10, you can download the app and get access to digital subscriptions. You get free comics. You can access our graphic novels. It's all the same functionality that you get with the Apple and Android apps. I want to say a very big thank you to everyone who has enjoyed the John Wagner three-parter interview. The response has been absolutely fantastic, so thank you to everyone who's left a comment, who's tweeted and Facebooked us, and left a star rating on iTunes. We're going to be having more creator interviews over the course of the next few months. But this week on the Thrillcast, we're going to be taking a look at a very special book and something outside of the normal 2000 AD reprint editions. Gold Tiger is an original publication put together by Guy Adams and Jimmy Broxton. It collects together the Poseidon Complex, which was a series of newspaper strips by Antonio Baretti and Lewis Schaefer from the 1960s, and the history behind it and how the guys have put this all together is absolutely fascinating. We had quite a bumper Ask Tharg in the last episode, and we'll have more in the future. But we do need your questions. If you have a burning query that you would like the alien editor of 2080, Tharg the Mighty, to answer, then please do email them into thrillcast@2000adonline.com. That's thrillcast, all one word, @2000adonline.com. Now, Gold Tiger is something a little bit different for 2000 AD. It's a collection of work by Antonio Baretti and Louis Schaeffer, which was one of the 1960s greatest unseen comics. And Guy Adams and Jimmy Broxton are the guys who have brought out this secret history of, to be quite frank, a strip that I didn't know existed. You know, I'm familiar with Modesty Blaze. I'm familiar with things like Garth, which was a strip that ran in British newspapers. The Gold Tiger was new to me, and it's great to welcome Guy and Jimmy onto the podcast so that we can talk about this new archival project which is out now. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Thank you very much. And you're in good company because lots of other people hadn't heard of it either. So don't feel too ashamed about that.
Well, let's bring them into the light. Let's explain to them what Gold Tiger was.
Do you want to do this, Jimmy, or shall I do this?
You do it. Why not?
All right.
If you get it wrong, I'll just moan at you and correct you as you go along.
Well, that's the thing. See, this is the problem with writers and artists. Straight away, I have to ask my artist if it's acceptable for me to talk. And it's problems like this that make a great series like Gold Tiger just dead to the world for years because two creators couldn't get on. So Gold Tiger was an attempt by the basketball newspaper group to cash in on the success of Modesty Blaze. There was, as you mentioned, Modesty Blaze. I mean, obviously it was a huge deal back then. And so they commissioned Louis Schaeffer, who was a sort of moderately successful pulp author, although that description would infuriate him no end, but that's basically what he was to come up with some scripts.
Act for hire is what you really mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Act for hire. I mean, you know, he was the main thing he liked signing was checks rather than his books. But they paired him up with this completely different personality, Antonio Baretti, who was an Italian artist. And bringing with him all the baggage of that wonderful European fieriness, that they couldn't have been more different. Mm. And from the word go, they're clashing. And it becomes clear that the work Baretti is doing and the control Baretti wants to put on the strip is producing something that the newspapers are not going to want. I mean, predominantly, it seems annoyingly reductive to bring it down to this, but predominantly the fact that the two main characters are both gay, which obviously is a major issue in 1966. Mm. Just that one fact alone means your strip's canned, you know. So it was always going to be a bit of a torturous history. And so, yeah, the strip never ran. It was cancelled before it was even published. But Baretti negotiated for the rights, kept the rights, and refused to let the work drop. And so constantly produced with Louis Schaeffer chasing behind him, trying to make sure he was still involved in this project because 50% of this creation was his. And this newspaper strip still develops, even though it didn't really have a home, not for many years anyway. It did eventually sort of find some level of success in Malta, of all places.
And explain a little bit about, because the main characters, you've already mentioned both gay, but you've got Lily Gold and Jack Tiger who come together to make Gold Tiger. These were very much in the kind of 1960s. They'd say Modesty Blaze, Avengers, as in the British Avengers, not the American ones. That kind of, you know.
No, the kinkier Avengers.
Yes, yeah. That kind of high-kicking, fashion-conscious, slightly campy, James Bond-esque adventure stories, weren't they?
Yeah. And Just a complete side note. I don't know if you know this, Jimmy, but I found out the other day Gold Tiger is also the name for Brenda Poppers.
Is it really?
So
it's me.
I'm deeply hoping that we were saying how no one's heard of Gold Tiger. I suspect that a fan somewhere owns a laboratory, which is terribly sweet. But for obvious legal reasons, I would like to make it clear that nobody involved with this book, even those who are dead, have anything to do with Popper. Thank you. except for Jimmy, who needs them to get through the long, long nights.
So, Jimmy, let's talk a little bit about Antonio Baretti, who, even by the standards of his time, he was quite an obscure artist. What was he like as an artist and a personality?
Yeah, well, as you say, he was quite obscure, but I think a lot of the Italian artists were, but they're only obscure to us. I mean, some of them are obviously superstars in Italy, which has a different attitude and a different towards comics and a richer culture of comics in many ways. Lots of Italian artists that did find their way into obviously UK comics, as many of us know, but he was always a little different. And I think he, mainly because he was so difficult on every level, whether it be editorial, creatively, he definitely, beat his own drum, and he was only really interested in that. So he was lucky to find any collaborators at all. So in many respects, he was lucky to get Schaefer even. Mm. I think, technically as an artist, he was in the European tradition. So long established, naturalistic draftsmanship. Sort of the antithesis of the Kirby influence, really, I always think, which is kind of where many of the newspaper strips come from, going back to the early US ones. There's always a more illustrative, not in the sense that they're not good comic storytelling, but just in terms of technique, if you know what I mean. So it's quite a different sensibility to the traditional American comic book, a market that, as I understand, Guy might know different with some of his research, that Baretti never really tapped into that US market at all. So he was perfect for Gold Tiger, really. At least, maybe not in terms of temperament, but I think in terms of technique and style. He could give Holdaway and some of those guys a run for their money in terms of producing a monthly strip, the way it actually looks.
Yeah, yeah.
His hand was perfect, but his head was no use at all.
Really? Yeah. Well, there's a wonderful moment. I mean, we've briefly touched on the personality conflicts between Baretti and Schaefer, and there's a wonderful moment about halfway through the book where you're detailing letters that were sent back and forth between Baretti and Schaefer, and I love the fact that Baretti refers to Schaefer as, well, calls him writer. And refers to himself as artist.
They were just such a great find, weren't they? They're brilliant.
There's another great moment where in one of the letters he says they're arguing about Baretti not following the script, and Baretti just says, "Do not send scripts again. I could not bear it. I've made things better." I mean, this really speaks of a fundamental mismatch of talents.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of like these two people that are accidentally chained together and wanting to run in different directions. Baretti's determined that with that freedom, it's all of a sudden, okay, fine, this is now mine. I can do whatever I want with it. And he's running ahead and wondering why it's still slightly difficult. And then he glances over his shoulder and sees this tweed sports jacket wearing writer dragging in the dust behind him because they're manacled at the ankles. and suddenly realizing, I'm surprised they didn't kill one another. Really, that's the only way out of their situation, wasn't it? One of them should have killed the other, and then they could have just done what they wanted.
Let's talk about why the two of you have chosen to collaborate on bringing all this research material. It's quite in-depth. You've gone through newspaper archives, you've gone through personal correspondence. There was an ill-fated attempt at reprinting Gold Tiger a number of years ago. Why did you decide to take this on and tell the story of Gold Tiger?
Jimmy can't spell. That's why.
It's true. He's got me there, and he can't draw. So, you know,
I can't draw. So I tying up his shoelaces, and he was doing the heavy lifting. That's basically how it worked. He got all the art. He was doing all the hard work. I just came and swept up a few commas behind him.
Well, I knew I couldn't do it on my own. I mean, obviously, as the book sort of, you know, goes into some detail at the start, I did come across the artwork, and I was determined that it needed, you know, that it should find an audience, but I knew I couldn't do it on my own for all sorts of reasons. And I was already working with Guy via Madefire. So I just said, have a look at this. You know, what do you think? Do you fancy sort of trying to bring this to the world? And because we're kind of into many of the same things, he said, yes, of course. Is that not right, Guy?
It is. Yeah, and it was, you know, I think, as you say, it was a lot of work. Obviously, it was a lot of work, and it was more than either of us could have dreamt of doing on our own. Not that I would have, because, you know, when Jimmy brought the project to me, I to be honest, like you, I was not familiar with Gold Tiger at all. Mm. And so it was as much a kind of process of discovery for me as it is for a lot of the readers. I've just sort of beat them by a few years, but. You know, it was just very useful, obviously, to have the two of us to be able to, on one hand, deal with the sort of illustrative layout, kind of design based stuff. Mm. You know, obviously, Jimmy's knowledge of Italian art, of comic art in general, far outstrips my own. And I suppose in many ways, it was fun for me to be looking at some of the letters, as we've said, the newspaper articles. That's kind of more playing into my area, because I've done nonfiction books before. I have some sort of background in that, and so between the two of us, you know, we managed it.
And I mean, without wishing to spoil the contents of the book and the story of what happened to Baretti and Schaefer. Did you find that as a writer and as a team of a writer and an artist, you could see parallels in their relationship? You could draw lessons from their relationship in terms of the way that you relate to other creators.
Yeah, Jimmy, go on. You take this one.
Definitely. I mean, that's the thing. We've sort of touched on this in other interviews as well, or other people we've spoken to. You know, are you basically Baretti and Schaefer, they've said. And Guy has pointed out that there's a little bit of Schaefer and there's a little bit of Baretti in all of us, I think. Anybody involved in the comics industry will identify with them, I think, in some way. Mm. Because we've all seen the egos at play and how that sort of can cause problems across the board. And the industry does seem to be, I wouldn't say rife with it, but shall we call them characters? we're not going to mention any names here, but we all know somebody who's a Baretti or probably a Schaefer. So yeah. I think in a way it's almost universal. But all of those, the best and the worst aspects of the industry seem to have been distilled into these two individuals. Mm. In what we think is an entertaining, maybe not so entertaining for them, but very entertaining for us to sort of see it as sort of innocent bystanders, I think.
And it's difficult, isn't it? Because you kind of, I don't know, I look at them and you know, as a creative person, I part of me, without the fragility, without the sort of shattered personality and quite simply the ego, but would love to be Baretti, would love to be someone that just didn't care, you know, just ploughed their own furrow, as it were. You know, there's something intensely noble, intensely attractive about that. So it's not chasing popularity. It's not trying to court, not trying to deal in artistic matters as if it's a business. Mm. And yet, you know, for most of us, of course, it is a business. You know, it's our livelihoods. It's how we pay the bills. So there's always going to be that contradiction. There's always going to be those moments where you're something you might really want to do, you look at it and go, yeah, but if I do that, no one's going to touch it. I can't do that. Mm. I've got to be more commercial. I've got to, you know, takes that. And that's the Schaefer side. The person that doesn't even care about that just follows the money.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very romantic notion that you know, many people fall into of you know, the creator, you know, the genius creator who, as you say, ploughs his own furrow, doesn't listen to the naysayers and the critics, and is therefore a genius because of it. Because of course that is so multifaceted, so rife with arrogance and downfall. The it's very rare that you do actually get people who are geniuses with.
So on the subject of downfall, I think Jimmy just fell over.
Yeah, that was a very bizarre sound, Jimmy.
But you know, I hope we keep that in because like we were adding sound effects to the sort of context of our conversation, which was lovely.
I've only had one beer. It's only 3 o'clock, so don't worry. Give me 20 minutes.
That was his breakfast beer. Yeah.
Yes, it was a good morning beer.
but no, you're quite right. You know that it's because that's the thing with sort of the really sort of blazing creatives is they have to be amazing. The amazing ones survive it. You can see some people that seem to be able to write whatever books they want, draw whatever art they want, make whatever music they want, and they rise to the surface. They survive at it because they have got that extra something special, and equally we all know that the sort of the marvelous artists, in inverted commas, of any kind of medium, that believe themselves to be these great unsung geniuses that just produce the most awful things with utter conviction, and in its own way that's also just delicious, isn't it?
Why is Gold Tiger, why are Baretti and Schaefer the side of the line between genius and imbecile that means they deserve recognition, they deserve remembrance? What is it about Gold Tiger that is so worth preserving in what is, you know, a gorgeous book?
Go on, Jimmy, go on.
Well,
go on, boy.
That's a big question, isn't it? I mean, following on from what Guy was saying about, you know, genius and, you know, these, you know, great artists, whether, you know, it's a Kubrick or whatever, you know. But a lot of those geniuses were able to operate or were determined to operate like that, but they did have commercial success. And the public sort of, you know, forgave them their indulgences and sort of went with them. But, you know, Baretti never had that. He never had that adulation. Although the genius might have been there and there might have been brilliance in the work, but it went unnoticed, and I think that's a real tragedy, I think. So it was ripe for rediscovery, I think. And it is of its time, so I wouldn't say it was ahead of its time and now that day has come. But I think you can look at it now with 21st century eyes and see something different that, you know, back then wouldn't have been picked up on, because it does have more depth, I think, as well as being, you know, sort of fun and crazy and all the rest of it. It's a universal tale. I think Guy would agree with that. That needed to be out there, needed to be archived and exist, not just, you know, in a database, you know, but an actual book. Seemed very fitting somehow to me.
Yeah.
I mean, we all love unsung heroes, don't we? We love the idea that, you know, I mean, obviously, as far as these two are concerned, it's the adulation has probably come far too late. I mean, who knows with Baretti, but you know, by all accounts, Schaefer is certainly likely to be very, very dead, so he doesn't care anyway. But the fact that after all of this kind of tumultuous relationship, all of this constant knocking back, because, you know, let's not forget it wasn't just the newspaper strip that was not run by its original commissioning paper. Baretti also trying to push the work towards 2000 AD, thinking, I've found my moment. Here we go. This is where Gold Tiger can now thrive. I was too early. This is going to be where it takes flight. And of course, yet again, we have no interest in your work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's wonderful bad luck, isn't it? To sort of twice sort of feel that you're sawing the crest of this creative moment, and then just to be utterly knocked back.
Well, I was going to ask about the 2000 AD connection, because I imagine one or two people listening to the podcast thinking, well, why aren't they talking about 2000 AD? But of course, there is this, as you say, tragic and in some ways funny connection to 2000 AD. Do you want to explain a little bit more about it, Guy?
Well, yeah, it's you know, obviously 2000 AD was being born, and it was a period in British comics where there was more, again, sense of experimentation, sense of vitality, perhaps. It was a, you know, a good surge of a creative period. You can tell I'm a writer. There's just the most wonderfully descriptive words. There's just a beautiful sentence. Yeah, I may transcribe that later just to see how utterly illiterate it is.
Too many bloody words in your sentences. That's all it is. You
know, yeah. Too much bloody beer in your artistry. And so, you know, Bretty looks at this and hears about it, because obviously 2008 he was drawing European talent. And so, We don't actually, there's no record as to how he heard about it. We don't know who sort of tipped him off. But all of a sudden, he doesn't even inquire, because, you know, I've got this idea, I've got this thing that you might be interested in, like any normal creator would. Doesn't approach an editor, just sends art, sends finished art, sends two pages in, said, you know, here, this will be your new main strip. You know, I trust you adore it, more to follow. You know, it's just this utter confidence of, you know, to hell with Dan Dare. I mean, God, who cares about Dan Dare? Gold Tug, this is what you want. Here we go. And you can imagine the sort of response that sort of attitude is going to get. And predictably enough, it did. But at the same time, you're trying to grab as much potential material. You're building a weekly comic. You know, it's a lot of work. So someone's sending you stuff that's perhaps not entirely awful. So they did pursue it. They got Dave Gibbons in to have a look and try and assist maybe a bit with the art, bring it slightly more towards the kind of English sensibilities, perhaps, or just to kind of appropriate it a bit. Maybe it's difficult to quite tell what the thinking was there, but. Predictably enough, it just wasn't going to happen, and terms couldn't be agreed, and Bretty just kept dropping his price as to how much he was willing to take.
They still didn't want it.
And they still didn't want it. But then he was after control as well, and of course that just, you know, we used to, I always want to say the 2008 credit card, and I know it's not that anymore, but that's my age showing. But, you know, we're talking about a period where the writers and artists of strips weren't generally speaking known. It was a much more kind of almost factory floor thing, where it was all about the story. It was all about the art. There was no cult of creator. So anyone wanting to retain their copyright, retain their identity within that work, British comics didn't work that way, not at that point. So, I mean, there was always going to be a clash there.
There's that marvellous moment in the section about when he was trying to pitch it to 2000 AD, where Kevin Gosnell, one of the, you know, legendary figures of early 2000 AD, just replied to one of his submissions, just saying, "Dear Mr. Bretty, no thank you." and he didn't even sign it. He just signed on behalf of Kevin Gosnell, which is really wonderful.
I like to think that was Pat Mills.
and what's really nice is that you've got the original five pages of Gold Tiger 2000, which was the strip that he was trying to get into early 2000, in the book, reproduced from the original artwork. And looking at it now, I mean, it's gorgeous. It's just not 2000 AD at all, is it? I mean, you've got sort of camp action. You've got people wandering around in revealing costumes. It's all very adult. He didn't really make any concession to it being a kids' comic.
No, not at all.
No, it's so inappropriate. I mean, even though, you know, back in those days, 2000 AD was breaking lots of new ground, but it wasn't breaking that kind of ground, you know, and it was never going to fly, was it? And it was also oddly dated even then. Is in a way, it was sort of early 70s sci-fi, you know, sort of Zardoz and sort of post-Barbarella rather than, you know, Star Wars. But yet there is some Star Wars stuff in there.
Yeah.
Or Star Wars looking that predates the film, which is, it's that weird mix of getting it right in some respects and getting it so wrong in others that makes it so interesting, I think.
Yeah.
Looking at it now.
You think of that original lineup and think what it really needed was a space saga about forced procreation. That was the one thing they were missing, isn't it? You know, we had sort of nice kind of future war invasion stuff. We had, you know, we had future sport and Harlem Heroes. We had Dan Dare, and he'd get a brilliant glove later on. But what we really didn't have was naughty space fetuses and strange star captains that are just demanding the right to procreate because babies are all, you know, it's strange it didn't run. I mean, it was an obvious omission to the lineup. I can't, to this day, I look at it and think, I can't see how that wasn't, it's just a standard of sci-fi storytelling. fetus, slightly spermy stories. You know, there's not enough spermy stories in 2008's initial run, and there could have been.
Now, we've been chatting away for a little while about Gold Tiger, but of course, this has all been a conceit which sits at the heart of the book, and that conceit is that none of this has been true. You guys have created...
I love to think that this is the point in the thrill cast where just people go, oh, for God's sake. I like to imagine an iPod hurled across the room.
Yeah. Is this going out on April 1st? Is that the plan?
But it's I mean, it's delicious. It's wonderful that you guys have created a meta-fictional history of a comic book that never was, and you've woven it into comic book history, but also 2000 AD history. One of you, tell us a bit about how this project came about and the whole Kickstarter thing and you know, how we've ended up publishing Gold Tiger.
Well, again, it did start with Jimmy, really. So, Jimmy... Take it away.
Okay.
It was your fault. It's always your fault. Everything is your fault.
It is always my fault. That's very true. I did have an idea. I've had an idea kicking around for a few years, really, that I wanted to do a classic newspaper strip style project because I just love them, you know. And I'm just born for sort of 30 years too late because the adventure strip market doesn't really exist anymore, but I still wanted to do one. But didn't think too seriously about it, but I knew I wanted it to be something in the 60s along the lines of Modesty Blaze or, you know, with a bit of Barbarella, sort of a sexy adventure, James Bond. I didn't have much more of a hook than that, but I knew I wanted to do it. But I also, the thing I did have sort of figured out that I wanted to present it as if it was real, as an artifact, you know, as an archive thing. But it didn't go beyond that. I wanted it to be authentic, you know, in a way, and you could kind of pretend. A bit like, you know, when they did 1963, you know, Alan Moore and all that sort of, you know. So you sort of turn the clock back, but everybody knows, but it's presented as if it was a real thing, but everybody's in on the gag. So I said to Guy, would you be interested in doing something like that? I didn't have characters, I didn't have a name or anything. I was working with Guy and I said, would you be interested in doing a sort of a 60s newspaper strip like this? And of course, he said yes, otherwise we wouldn't be chatting here now, would we? But he took it in such a direction that I never, you know, even imagined. You know, all of the meta stuff and then the fictional creators all came from Guy, and that all came later, you know, that, and then it just sort of started evolving, and that side of it became as almost, in fact, more of the story than the story itself. Would you agree, Guy? That's kind of how it. I blame you, basically, for all this nonsense.
Okay, so I thought it was your fault, but maybe it's my fault. perhaps we're just both to blame for the horror that is Gold Tiger, for the world-baiting menace of Gold Tiger. Well, yeah, but it was one of those ideas that. Once you start to think, Dan, that it's because, like, you know, as you say, you wanted it to feel of its time. You wanted to present it not as a modern writer and artist just doing an adventure strip. He wanted it to feel like the real thing. And so, you know, once you start going down this path of, okay, so who was the artist? Who was the writer? It gets carried away. And the two of us, well, we're very collaborative, actually, because we talk constantly. We bounced ideas backwards and forwards. And I think one of the main things was just this constant snowball of enthusiasm, which can be incredibly productive. So once you really get your teeth into an idea and you it pleases you and you find it thrilling.
When you're putting a book like Gold Tiger together, it in order to appear real, it can't be too. Something can't be too extreme, because obviously you've got to have people. You're playing with their sense of disbelief. So, as the book goes along and Baretti's mind essentially snaps, how do you keep that going? How do you maintain that kind of focus through an entire work of art like this that is very kind of disparate in that you've got, you know, memos and letters, but then you've got editor's notes from the modern age. You've got like a gallery of things. You've got the weird history of its involvement with 2000 AD. How as a creative team, do you kind of keep that consistency going all the way through?
You just accept it's real, I think right. You know, it's the conceit is one that we held on to fiercely. I mean, we for a long time we pushed that we wouldn't even discuss that it was fake once the book had come out, because it had got to the point, I think, where it was so important that it was read with a straight face almost. I don't know, that sounds sort of kind of contradictory considering some of the subject matter of it, but you know what I mean? It approached in that kind of way. Because that's how it plays. But it comes from the sort of heights of mad stuff down to the really tiny little minutiae, and that's where you ground things. So it's like the relationship with Baretti and his sister and stuff. That's where the real stuff anchors everything else, I think.
Mm. Yeah, and I think it's interesting you say with a straight face, and that is key to the whole thing. Although, you know, it's light and frothy in many respects and quite funny, the strip, but it is played straight. I mean, it has been described incorrectly, I think, as a spoof or a pastiche. And it isn't, is it, Guy? It's not that. It had to read convincingly, and you had to believe that this could be a strip from that time. It's not Austin Powers. You know, it's not, you know, a riotous send-up. And it's very affectionate, and it's respectful, I think, to the period. Mm. And that's important, I think. Otherwise, it just becomes a complete farce, which is doable and can be fun, but that's not what this is.
No, it's not a spoof at all.
No, it's not.
But I mean, just in the sense that, you know, we wanted to, but again, that goes right back to your original desire to present it as a real thing, to never have, a spoof wouldn't, spoofs can be perfectly fun, but spoofs are kind of disposable because they're just winking. They're winking at their audience. Mm. And we didn't want that. We wanted it. All of our winks were lascivious.
Yes. And in character. But the characters wink sometimes, but the book doesn't.
Yeah. Well, Jimmy, I was going to ask you, flicking through the book, you've had to be a real chameleon with all the art in here, because it's not just the case that you've drawn newspaper strips in 1960s European style as if they are newly scanned from original artwork. Mm. But you've also got pencils in there, you've got posters, you've done covers. The artwork evolves over the course of the book as Baretti's personality changes and things move on. You've got the wonderful five pages of Gold Tiger 2000 in there, which is just absolutely riotous. How did you sort of take on that chameleon skin for this? Was it a real challenge to switch from one thing to another?
Well, it was and it wasn't, because obviously I've got quite a sort of diverse background in design and things, and I've always worked in different styles you know, depending on the project. So that's not new to me, but it is new to sort of focus all of those things into one complete work, as it is. So in many ways, it was an opportunity to sort of play with that, which is always nice, and it's good to sort of flex your creative muscles and try different things. But what made this more interesting for me, and hopefully for readers, is there was a legitimate reason to do that. So, you know, sort of partway through the book, we've got one of those crazy sort of 1960s sweat mags, you know. So Beretti was involved in sort of doing covers for those. So you've got sort of what appears to be a fully painted sort of girly mag cover. So it's completely different to the rest of the artwork. So that was an opportunity for me to sort of to try and create something like that. But it was, the script kept it on track, because I had two sets of the script. Guy will hopefully remember that. I had a complete script for the strips, but I also had a separate script with all the incidental and text pieces that sort of intertwined, if you see what I mean. So I could sort of cross-reference. And I didn't, the way I worked on it, I didn't draw all the strips and then go back and do all of the sort of ancillary or additional material. It was all done pretty much in order, the way the book is, in sequence. And that helped, because you need to know where, as you say, you need to know where you are with something like this, because there's a lot of stuff in there. And the artwork naturally developed, just because art just tends to, as you do more and more stuff, your style kind of develops. But because of Beretti's psychological breakdown, there was an opportunity to really sort of push the boat out, but still have it work, hopefully.
And you originally put this together as a Kickstarter. Tell us a little bit about how, obviously, the people who funded the Kickstarter are getting their books, but we have decided to take this on as a book that 2000 AD is publishing. Do you want to tell us a bit about how all that came to be?
This is for you, Guy, I think.
Yeah.
Well, the loveliest people in the world are our backers. Well, it's, you know, it seemed to us, I think we did ask around a little bit, but only in a casual sense. It seems such an alternative idea that I think a bit like we expected to be treated like Beretti. We thought no one's going to want to publish this. So, you know, the notion of it being effectively self-published and doing it via Kickstarter just seemed really the only viable route. So we set that up, and that was a wonderfully stressful few weeks waiting to be funded, and then we were funded, and that was lovely. And then the world continued to go wrong on an almost monthly basis, which is, you know, which is life. But I mean, it really has been the most ridiculous period doing this for both of us, but particularly for Jimmy. But the most sort of mundane of all of it was the fact that the printer went bankrupt.
One day we'll write the book of sort of the behind the scenes of how it all sort of came about.
It'll be us in our old age. Yeah. Beretti and Schaefer. And it'll be writer and artist. By the way, that you mentioned earlier about, you know, calling each other writer and artist. Jimmy always calls me writer. Right. Or Jimmy's partner in particular. You've been talking to the writer.
Is that the writer, yeah. I mean, it really, but without going into sort of details and sort of depressing everybody, it was an incredibly eventful few. One day they'll write country and western songs about us, I think. But when it all comes out, it really was hard to take. That's why it took much longer than it should have. Mm. But we did get there in the end. As I say, the printer went bankrupt. But we did always have our mind, hopefully, on a proper publisher. You know, so it wouldn't just be, not to, you know, in any way sort of denigrate the Kickstarter edition, which is different to the Rebellion one. But did we not go? We always hoped, at least, that we would find a proper mainstream publisher so that it would find a much wider audience. Mm. We never made a secret of that.
I think, you know, but I think it's natural to, what we wanted to do is create a really beautiful thing, let that thrive, survive, do whatever it would amongst that sort of kind and devoted audience. And then, yeah, I think both of us, as the thing is, once you've created something, you've put so much into, and I think also, to be honest, when personal lives are being so fractured on the outside of that, the book itself becomes of such weight, such ridiculous weight, actually, that, you know, you do get to the point where you think, you know, I really want this to live. I want this to thrive somehow. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, as Jimmy says, that's not, it's, that runs risks of sounding like the Kickstarter edition is to us wasn't enough. It's not that so much. It's just, you know, when we had to look to alternative methods for practical reasons, but we also wanted to see if more people liked what we'd made. Mm. Because once we'd made it, we did start to wonder if maybe it wasn't quite as utterly poisonous as far as publishing would be concerned. Because, I mean, you know, it's when we talked, we were upholding the conceit, you know, that the Schaefer-Baretti kind of divide. With Schaefer's head on, you look at Gold Tiger and think, forget it. Mm. No one's going to want to publish that, buy it, read it. And yet, you know, the reviews we've got, I don't know how many people are buying it, but the reviews have just been almost dauntingly lovely. You know, it's we keep reading reviews where people completely get it and love it. Mm. And, you know, I mean, we did this interview last week, and I think both Jimmy and I were sort of slightly on the back foot thinking, okay, well, I don't know if she'll like it. Has she read it yet? I think, well, she sounded like she was enthused by it, so she'd be okay. And then she came on, she said, I've literally just finished the book. And it's that point you think, oh God, this whole interview starts now. It's like a parallel universe is formed at that point. Mm. There's one interview where there's a lot of crying and swearing, and Jimmy probably, you know, hangs up before I do, but only by about 3 minutes.
Yeah,
and then I shout some more things, and I also hang up, and then we get this wonderful piece of press where, you know, two fools make awful thing. But thankfully, we lived in the other parallel world, which she really liked it.
I think, coming back to what you've been saying before about this not being a pastiche, this not being a satire, I think that may well be people reacting to the genuine affection that you guys have put in for this period. You know, a period of comics that was full of larger-than-life characters, both on and off the page. You know, I've read it. It really comes through the whatever the conceit, whatever whether people think it's real or not. You guys have got affection for the thing that you're doing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, I think the thing you get at the end of it, if you've enjoyed it, obviously, is you desperately want it to be real.
Yeah.
And I think that if that's the feeling you leave people with, we've succeeded. If you see what I mean, because it's a shame that it doesn't actually exist. I think if that makes any sense, I certainly wish it was real. I wouldn't have had to bloody draw it then, would I? I could have just scanned a lot of artwork. But yeah.
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed chatting about Gold Tiger, whether real or fictional, and thank you guys for talking to us about it, and hope the book does really, really well.
A pleasure.
Take care. Bye.
Cheers now. Bye. Well, that is another 2000 AD Thrillcast Earthlitz. I hope you enjoyed the chat with Guy and Jimmy. Gold Tiger is definitely worth your time and money, and that's currently available from all good stockists, and also the 2000 AD online shop and your local comic book store. Like I said at the beginning of the episode, this week's prog is ideal for new and lapsed readers, so do make sure, if you're not reading 2000 AD, you pick up a copy and get back into the flow of reading the galaxy's greatest comic. In the meantime, see you in a fortnight, Earthlitz, Splundig, Verthrig, Squawks, Deck, Thargo. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2000 AD is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2000 AD is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2000adonline.com, or you can download the free 2000 AD app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta 2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000AD. Make sure you stay Zarjaz, Earthlitz, Splundig Verthrig.